Belgic Confession, Article 27, the Catholic Christian Church. We believe and profess one Catholic or universal church, which is a holy congregation of true Christian believers, all expecting their salvation in Jesus Christ, being washed by his blood, sanctified, and sealed by the Holy Ghost. This church hath been from the beginning of the world, and will be to the end thereof, which is evident from this, that Christ is an eternal King, which, without subjects, he cannot be. And this holy church is preserved or supported by God against the rage of the whole world, though she sometimes, for a while, appears very small, and in the eyes of men to be reduced to nothing, as during the perilous reign of Ahab, the Lord reserved unto him 7,000 men who had not bowed their knees to Baal. Furthermore, this holy church is not confined, bound, or limited to a certain place or to certain persons, but is spread and dispersed over the whole world, and yet is joined and united with heart and will by the power of faith in one and the same Spirit. We need to say more about the meaning of the holiness of the church. Last time, regarding the holiness of the church, we noticed that that holiness is the holiness of people, not things, and of the church's membership, not merely the office bearers. And with regard to the other noun in that phrase, the holiness of the holiness of the church is its separation from sin and the world, spiritually, and her devotion to the triune God in love. That's all established. Everyone has got that straight. Now, this holiness of the church, is it legal or organic? Legal refers to a declaration of God the judge. Organic means pertaining to an organism, a living entity. Legal or organic?
Organic.
Is it partly legal? No, it's wholly organic. Remember what we learned about the justification, wholly legal, justification of the individual, and sanctification, wholly organic. Now we're moving from the individual to the corporate. And remember, too, our classes on Belgic Confession 23 and 24 on justification and sanctification. Again, I ask, is the holiness of the church imputed or infused? By imputed, we mean reckoned to someone's account, so it's an accounting term, and infused means poured in. Is the holiness of the church imputed or infused?
Infused.
Is it partly imputed? No, it's wholly infused, just as sanctification of the individual is wholly infused and not at all imputed. And it's worth making these points because an awful lot of material on the holiness of the church will mention that it's maybe partly legal or maybe partly imputed, and I don't think that's helpful at all. Another question. The holiness of the church, does it mean that Christ is objectively holy for us, or that we and the whole church are subjectively holy? The holiness of the church, does it refer to Christ's being objectively holy, or to our being subjectively holy?
Well, the church is holy because the church is Christ's, and Christ is holy. So therefore, I will say, subjectively, the church is holy.
Okay. The answer is that we are subjectively holy. That's what the holiness of the church means, that we, subjectively, in ourselves, by God's grace, are subjectively holy. It is undoubtedly the case that Christ is objectively holy, he who's at God's right hand, and that we receive our subjective holiness from Christ. But the holiness of the church is our holiness, the holiness that's infused into us as an organic holiness. Is the holiness of the church hypothetical or real?
Real.
It's a real holiness. An organic, living holiness that is infused into the church. So that the church is really and truly subjectively holy. That is, it's spiritually separated from the ungodly world, and it is consecrated to Jesus Christ, its head and saviour. Another one, a fifth one. Is the holiness of the church a goal or an attainment?
It'll be a goal and a realisation. I don't think attainment's the best word.
Have we attained to it?
No.
Yes.
Then we're not holy.
I say we, well, without it, you can't see goals, so we have to attain it.
It's both. This one is both. The holiness of the church is an attainment. We have attained to the holiness. Not fully, but partly. Because the church already is, really, organically and subjectively holy. In the present, right now. But the holiness of the church is also a goal for the future. Because now, though we are really holy, we are imperfectly holy.
I think that's what I was saying about it, is we haven't reached it. So.
Yes, because the word attainment could mean, have you got some of it or have you got all of it? Yes, there's a certain ambiguity in that word.
Pastor, just going back, I mean, you did say, and obviously there are people who hold it, is there not some sense in which the holiness of the church, just as justification was secured in the sense of the cross, the holiness...
Oh, it's secured at the cross, yeah.
Is there not some legal sense in the holiness of the church?
No, there's a legal basis in which God can sanctify us. But the holiness is the consecration to Christ that is by nature subjectively inwrought, infused.
100%.
The holiness is legal. There's a legal part to our salvation. Yeah. There's a legal basis without which we cannot be sanctified.
You're talking corporately, though.
Yes, but then the whole body of the church consists of individual people who are sanctified.
It's Rome that gets it back the front.
It is.
So there's legal basis to individual holiness, but not the church corporately. Is that right?
But there can be a legal basis to something, but the thing not be legal.
Okay.
There's right. There's a
that's
legal.
I'm getting confused now.
There's a legal bit. Ah, yeah, okay.
Legal to do with guilt, and holiness is to do with cleansing.
Yes. The legality of sin, guilt, so we're justified, and then the aspect of sin that's dealt with in sanctification is its pollution and power.
You see where I'm getting mixed up?
Oh, I can. It's not easy. Yeah. So the holiness of the church is an attainment. The church is holy now, imperfectly. But it will progress in its holiness. There's a sort of progressive holiness, progressive sanctification for the church in this life. And then the perfection of its holiness lies in the next life. And we're going to return to this later in our treatment of the holiness of the church. This idea of an imperfect holiness, though real, a progressive holiness, and then a perfect holiness. What I'd like to move to now, having restated the holiness of the church and sharpened it further, what I want to do now is say that the holiness of the church is the beauty of the church. The holiness of the church is the beauty of the church, and that thesis will be developed for the rest of this class. The holiness of the church is the beauty of the church. Let me prove this to you, especially by using some of the Bible texts on the handout entitled Scripture on Holiness as the Church's Beauty. Psalm 29 verse 2 has the phrase, the beauty of holiness. Holiness is beauty, and there's the beauty of holiness. And that phrase, the beauty of the holiness, is found in worship contexts, not only Psalm 29 verse 2, but 96 verse 9, 110 verse 3, 1 Chronicles 16 verse 29, and 2 Chronicles 20 verse 21. The beauty of holiness. Holiness is beautiful to God and to his people. And since beauty is in the eye of the beholder to a certain degree, holiness is not beautiful to the ungodly. Holiness is beautiful in the worship of the church, and holiness is beautiful in the church itself. Let's move on. There are texts on that page that speak of the holiness and the beauty of the church as a city, God's city. First, Psalm 48, verses 1 and 2. Follow with me. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness. And the next word is beautiful for situation. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion. Isaiah 52, verse 1. Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion. We looked at this not that long ago in a sermon. Put on thy beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. For henceforth there shall come unto thee no more the uncircumcised and the unclean. So there are texts which associate holiness and beauty in connection with the church as a city. Where we've got a cumulative case here. Let's look at some passages which speak of the holiness and therefore the beauty of the church, with the church not now as a city so much, but especially as a woman, Christ's bride. And we're going to go backwards through the texts, beginning at Revelation 21, verse 2. Revelation 21, verse 2. I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. So the church there is a city and a woman who's a bride, a woman who's a bride adorned for her husband. And the point about a bride's adornment on the day of her wedding is beauty. A holy city, a holy church, a holy woman, beautiful. Ephesians 5, 25 through 27 in the middle of the page. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify, make holy, and cleanse it, similar to sanctify, with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. Here's the church. Holy, sanctified, cleansed and washed. It's a bride, the bride of Christ. And if it doesn't have a spot or a wrinkle or any such thing, and if it's entirely without blemish, it is beautiful. Let's move to Song of Solomon, chapter 6, verses 3 and 4. The church here is speaking as the woman. I am my beloved's. Devotion to Jesus Christ, and my beloved is mine. He feedeth his flock among the lilies. And then he says to her, thou art beautiful, O my love, as Tirzah, comely as Jerusalem, terrible as an army with banners. So verse 3 deals with the holiness of the church, her devotion to Jesus Christ. And then he says to her, thou art beautiful. He finds her devotion to him beautiful. That's the beauty of the church. And if you look at Psalm 45, verses 10 through 11, which we sang earlier, you'll note the same point. Hearken, O daughter. These are words spoken to Christ's bride, the church. Hearken, O daughter, and consider and incline thine ear. Forget also thine own people and thy father's house. Separation from worldly interests and affairs, half of the main definition of sanctification, as it were. And then it says, so shall the king greatly desire thy beauty. If you're separated from other people and implied dedicated to me, then I, the king, desire thy beauty. So the holiness of the church there is her beauty. Now, I've taken quite a bit of time looking at various texts and proving this point from the idea of the beauty of holiness and the holiness of the church as a city being her beauty and the holiness of the church as a woman being her beauty, because this is a sort of platform. We're going to build on that. We need to make sure our foundation's right. Otherwise, the rest of the presentation falls to the ground. So we should pause here and say that though this idea of the holiness of the church as the church's beauty may not have been a way in which you've thought of it before, though it's an attractive idea, I think you'll have to admit, I want to be sure that you're all with me so far. Are there any objections or questions? Or let's move on now. Since we have seen this, that the holiness of the church is her beauty, we're going to apply this. A lot of this is going to be application tonight. The beauty of the church is therefore not the attractiveness of her church building. Oh, that's a beautiful wee church. We've all said it, and it's not even wrong. What we mean, it's a beautiful church building, right? But the beauty and holiness of the church is not that it has a soaring cathedral tower or lovely stained glass windows, if you like that sort of thing, or even strikingly modern architecture or lovely lighting. Just the wee rays coming out at the right point. Oh, it's just great. Of course, when we say that, we're not exhorting anyone to have an ugly church building. But we're saying that the beauty of the church is not the attractiveness of her church building. The beauty of the church is the beauty of the people, therefore it's the holiness of her members. Let's move on. Since the beauty of the church is the holiness of her members, the beauty of the church is not this. We see that congregation. I've never seen in one place on a Sunday morning so many handsome, trendy, cool people. You know, there's that phrase out there, the beautiful people. Well, see that church, they are just the beautiful people. That church consists of a lot of people who are sort of professionals or semi-professionals, and they're all well dressed in that church. Ah, oh, it's the sort of church I'd like to join. They've got costly clothing and attractive attire and fashionable fabrics. And in that church, there's some people with the very latest slick haircuts.
And big jeeps.
And big jeeps. And well-kitted out kids. My sort of people. So the beauty of the church is not that the people are like this. So when we say that the holiness of the church doesn't consist of these physically appealing virtues, or physically appealing things, we're not saying, of course, that this is an excuse for slovenliness. We're not saying that there is a virtue in coming to the church or the clothes you wear through the week. There's no virtue in being dowdy. But we are saying that the beauty of the church doesn't consist in those sorts of things. Having a nice winter coat and all that. Though, by all means, have a winter coat if it's cold. Yeah, good. The beauty of the church, therefore, is moral and ethical. It's not a matter of fashion or of good looks. And there are some people, when they hear that, feel rather relieved, you know, because they think they're never going to make the grade, and understandably so. We don't want anybody feeling pressure along lines like that. The beauty of the church is spiritual and not physical. The beauty of the church is principally internal, rather than principally external, though it does show itself in more tangible ways. A couple of observations here. The first one touches on something Brian was saying earlier. The nature of the church's beauty fits with the nature of God's grace. God's grace is essentially pleasantness and attractiveness. God works this grace in us, infused grace. I know there are some who do not like that way of speaking, but for all that, there is infused grace, which makes the church holy. So the holiness of the church is its beauty, its attractiveness, its pleasantness. The holiness of the church, being its beauty, fits perfectly with the grace of God, which works this holiness inside us. And that's exactly what you would expect, because the Bible is a book with one author And it all fits together. And here's a second point about the holiness of the church as being its beauty. This fits with what we said earlier, in an earlier class last week, or rather in an earlier class in this series on Belgian Confession 27. This fits with the church's invisibility. The church's invisibility concerns, for one thing, its election. Only God can see who are the elect. The invisibility of the church fits with its regeneration. Only God can see in a church, or even in people walking up and down the street, who are regenerated. And then the holiness of the church being primarily an internal, inwrought grace, well, only God can see who in the visible church is holy. And only God can see the degrees of holiness of various churches and individuals. Now, we've been talking here about beauty. And the main image for the holiness of the church as the beauty of the church in the Bible concerns women. And so we now want to apply the holiness and the beauty of Christ's bride, the church. We want to compare that to the beauty of women. Now, there are changes with regard to Christ's bride and to women. There are changes in their beauty. Now, with regard to women, you know, they grow more beautiful as they get older from a little girl, and then they sort of peak in their physical beauty. We'll not now say where they peak or where you all are on the road down, but they go up and then it sort of peaks, although it may plateau for a while. But eventually, if you live long enough, it will go down. It will go down. Now, with the church, there are no such problems like this. There's no aging process. There's no decline in beauty. The church grows more and more beautiful as she's sanctified by God, so that the church always improves with age. Here's a second comparison in the change in beauty. No woman's physical beauty is ever perfect. Even at her peak, and every woman would say, even at her peak, if I had a chance, I would change this, that, or the other. And we don't want to be, you know, sort of sore on women here. I mean, you could apply all these things to men, but they apply probably more so to women. Whereas the church, she will reach her perfect beauty, and she will hold it. She maintains it. She never loses it. She holds on to her beauty.
Could I just ask you about that previous point you made about the church getting more beautiful with age? Uh-huh. Are you saying then that the church now is more beautiful than it was during the Reformation?
Okay, Philip's asking the question about the church going more beautiful with age, and that deserves clarification. We're not saying that a church always goes forward. It's possible for a church to decline in holiness, right? That is a church, a particular congregation. What we mean really is, let's take a particular congregation. Ordinarily, and everything being well, though not every member necessarily is growing at the same rate, and some may be declining, the church as a whole increases in holiness. That's what we mean. And we're not even comparing necessarily the church in the 21st century to the church in the 16th century. And then with regard to more and more the church becomes perfected and then added, so that the whole aggregate of those who are part of the church, militant and triumphant, the whole thing grows in grace.
Could we say that from Christ established the church on earth, the church has always been preparing for her wedding, and she will be at her most beautiful on her wedding day?
Yes. Now let's talk about the lengths to which the two women, I mean, Christ's bride and women, the lengths to which they go to make themselves beautiful. And with regard to women, and of course some women put more effort into it than others, I should add a disclaimer here that my wife told me about some of these things, because I was blissfully ignorant of some of them. She told me about some things and I had put them down, and then I thought, no, I'm taking that out, I'm not going to talk about that. But there are lengths that women go to with regard to their physical beauty, and of course there are lengths that men will go to as well, some of which strike me, I don't know about you, as particularly painful and grievous. I'll explain. For instance, there are women, and indeed men, who go to the lengths of surgery. They go to the lengths of surgery to do things with their face and their belly and other bodily parts. And you wonder, you know, boy, it must be really, really important to them. We're not talking about some serious defect that they have, but just purely cosmetic. I mean, you had it actually with a man a while ago, Michael Jackson. I mean, he actually did so many operations, and I was actually curious about the whole thing. You could see in some of the earlier ones, I remember looking at this a while ago, that he actually, you could see that he improved himself. You know, you could say, okay, I would say, yes, that is actually more attractive. You know, even as a man, you could say that's more attractive, not many. But then the more he went on, it actually became ugly, I would have thought, by anyone's assessment. And part of it was, he didn't want to be black. But then there are a lot of black people who want to become more white, and a lot of white people who actually wish they were darker. But anyway, there's surgery. Some go to the length of surgery. Some people go to dieting and extreme dieting, destructive dieting. Anorexia, if you can, or bulimia. And there's some idea of self-image and what is beautiful. And it's destructive. Exercise is good for you, but there are some women, as well as some men, who get into exercises which are so heavy, and their workouts, in order to attain this body beautiful, that it absorbs far too much of their time and isn't actually good for them. And you think, that poor wee girl, she couldn't stand a blast in the winter. And if ever she was in a car accident, she could no beef. She'd just die. Like, you know, there's no reserves, nothing. If you're in a coma, why do you need to do that? What is the sense of that? And then, of course, you have other factors involving clothing. Corsets, I am told, are painful, and there's sorts of modern things that squeeze in. Mary even said to me that there are jeans which some women wear that are so skinny that they damage your circulation. In China, there's the idea of women having beautiful feet the smaller they are. I think that's on its way out now. And doctors will give you all sorts of warnings about high heels as being bad for your ankles. But anyway, I give you some suggestions. You know, there's an idea that I want to be beautiful, and I am prepared to take serious, some of us would even say extreme, difficulties to attain this physical beauty. With regard to the desire to be beautiful, this is a huge industry, the beauty industry. Anti-aging creams, Botoxing, all sorts of cosmetics. Here's a quote from one online website, not one I'm usually on, as you can well imagine, but I want to get a figure, and here is the sentence. The UK beauty industry is worth £17 billion per year and employs 1 million workers nationwide, making it one of the most lucrative industries in the country. Of course, then there's the question, how far do you take the beauty industry? Like, if you, George, go and get your hair cut, that might be included in the beauty industry too. But it's maybe not what we would necessarily think of. Worldwide, one estimate was that in 2017, the beauty industry, I wasn't sure if this included men and women, but the beauty industry will be worth $265 billion. Then, of course, there is the time spent in seeking to attain to beauty. Anyone remember how long Esther went through her purifications and preparations before she was brought to the king?
6 months.
Two periods of 6 months, yep. A 12-month period of preparation. 12 months. Now that to a man, at least to this man, just is absolutely staggering. I can't hardly imagine that. You'd be bored out of your mind. But with regard to time, you can work on your skin and you can work on your hair. You can tell this isn't my natural sort of subject, so I'm stumbling a bit. And then you have to spend a certain amount of time in the morning and before you go out. And there are some women, I've heard them say this, not personally to me, but they would say that if I went out without my perfume or without my makeup, I would feel naked. My point, despite all the personal take or analysis and all that, is that there's an awful lot of time and money and effort and even pain put into the body beautiful by women and also to a certain degree men. And what I want to get to with all that is, what about the church, which is Christ's bride, and the time and effort it puts into it? So for a woman, you put this amount of time and beauty, time and effort into physical beauty. What about time and effort put into spiritual beauty? And for men too, what about the time and beauty, time and effort we put into physical beauty? And everybody puts a certain amount in, and it's right and proper. You don't want to be totally scruffy or anything like that. And I'm told that within the UK, men from South Wales are particularly interested in personal grooming. And it's a very fast-growing market.
I should just say at this point, in defence of the women, I work in a sizable company and with men and women, obviously, and see the men where I work, they're every bit.
As bad,
if not worse in some cases.
If not worse, yeah.
The way they group themselves, it's unreal, something like
unreal.
They do. You really wouldn't believe it, what they tell you, they do to make themselves look handsome.
Yep. I mean, there's personal preference, but yeah, I think part of it though is our society is external beauty mad. Mm-hmm. There's no idea of anything deeper than the skin. One of those beauty websites I looked at said, some people think, novel idea, that beauty is actually deeper than skin. I'm thinking, what sort of world do these people live in? That's terrible. Purely secular world, if that's all people think and their thoughts never arise to anything God or deeper or eternal, the more secular you get, ordinarily, the more you're going to be concerned about beauty products. So how much time and effort then do we as men put into spiritual beauty, which is holiness? That is, reading the scriptures regularly and devoutly, as well as good reformed books and something like the standard bearer, doing family devotions and private prayer and lively church membership and serving one's fellow saints. These are spiritual exercises. These are exercises that work beauty, the beauty of holiness, just as exercise is good for the body and can also help make us more physically beautiful. And of course, these spiritual means of which I've been speaking are ways of receiving life, new life, eternal life. And that helps us stay and grow more spiritually vibrant. And it's good to be vibrant. That means just healthier and more beautiful and so forth. Let's approach the two from this angle, the two, that is the church as a woman and female beauty in this world. For whom is there beauty? For whom do those various parties make themselves beautiful? For whom do women make themselves beautiful? Now there's a question, a very philosophical question. Why do you do this? Who are we trying to impress?
For their respective husbands.
For their husbands, yep.
I would say as well, because there's a competition thing between them and the woman.
Yes. I think, you know what's interesting, Hilary, I don't remember what order they occurred to me, but I do know what order I wrote them down, some thoughts. And the first one I wrote down was other women. Because even I, as a rank outsider to this field, know that sometimes there are women who do it, sort of by a competition, but there's some women who make themselves beautiful to make other women jealous. And then sometimes a woman makes herself beautiful for her husband, but also for other men. Or for men in general, because they like male attention. And also, women, even if there was nobody else in the world, women also, and these things apply to men to some degree too, make themselves beautiful for themselves, to make themselves feel good. And at a certain level, that is natural and probably okay too. I mean, if you're in an old people's home, for instance, even the men like to get their hair cut. They like to get a shave. There's certain personal dignity. And I mention this because the Bible has this idea of the church as holy, holy as a woman and beautiful as a woman. And it does these things to try and make us think about, well, what happens out there with women and how does this apply to the church? The church seeks to be beautiful and holy, number one, for
Christ.
For Christ, for her husband's sake. For her husband's sake. And this is important for wives, for their own husbands. You don't think to yourself, well, I'm going to put on this new dress and look particularly handsome here for this other guy at work or even in the church. You think of your husband. The church seeks to be holy and beautiful also for evangelistic purposes as a witness to the world to gain others to Christ by her good works. Heidelberg Catechism, question and answer 86. You could even say that the church seeks to be holy and beautiful, and the individual believer does too, out of a certain godly self-interest. Because in the way of holiness, I am close to my husband Jesus Christ. I'm assured of his love, I enjoy that fellowship, and I have a good conscience. And this brings us to the subject of ugliness. Ugliness as applies to the two parties. Now, I'm not going to say anything about ugliness with regard to women, or men for that matter, because all of these things apply to men as well. We know what things are reckoned to be ugly, and we don't say any more about this. But what about the church? What are the things that make the church ugly? Because we've talked about the holiness of the church as her beauty, and what's the opposite of beauty? Ugliness. What makes the church ugly?
Sin.
Sin. That's it, one word. Yep.
Unfaithfulness.
Unfaithfulness. Here are some sins listed in Ephesians 4:31 that are ugly, and if found in a congregation, make that congregation to that extent ugly. Bitterness, wrath, anger, clamour, evil speaking, malice. Here's 2 Corinthians 12, verse 20. Contentions, envyings, wrath, strifes, backbitings, whisperings, swellings, tumults. In a word, if the holiness of the church is her beauty, it's the worldliness that makes the church ugly. Makes the church ugly to God and ugly to God's saints. And when a church gets really worldly and ugly, she becomes what?
A harlot.
She becomes a harlot. And the interesting thing about a harlot is that a harlot, like any other woman, also is concerned with beauty. A harlot's concerned with beauty. She needs beauty. She needs a certain beauty or she can't operate. She can't get customers. But she has a different view of beauty than the ordinary woman. It's external and it's sensual. Two different views of beauty. and then the church is no longer devoted to Jesus Christ. Such a church is not devoted to Jesus Christ as a bride. She's devoted to herself and to her lusts and to the world. So with regard to the true and the false church, we talk about the holiness of the true church. And with regard to the false church, we talk about the worldliness of the false church. And the false and departing churches, their members do not live holy lives. Their members live worldly lives. They think and behave like the world. And the more false they become, the more worldly they become. And they also think they're beautiful. With this other view of beauty. Let's turn now to Ephesians 5, verses 25 through 27, more especially though 26 and 27. To use contemporary language, this passage teaches that Jesus Christ is the church's spiritual beautician. A beautician is, after all, someone who makes someone else beautiful. In this instance, the church's beautician is her husband. Now, very few women have as their beautician their husband. But the church has as her beautician her husband. And this beautician, unlike other beauticians, this beautician makes the church beautiful for himself. Other beauticians make the woman beautiful for her husband or boyfriend or for her own feel-good factor. But Jesus Christ, the church's beautician, makes her beautiful for himself. So what then are the tools of the trade? A beautician has various implements and techniques. What are the tools that Jesus Christ, the church's beautician, uses? What are the ways that he beautifies his bride, the church? He uses, of all things, and there isn't a beautician in the world who would ever recommend this, he uses preaching, number one. In his high priestly prayer in John 17, verse 17, Christ asked the Father, sanctify, and therefore beautify them, the church, through the truth. Thy word is truth. And the truth, as preached, is especially a means of grace. What is baptism? Another means that he uses. It's the washing of regeneration, a special cleansing of the church. And there are all sorts of lotions, I'm told, that do magic things that men don't understand. Then there's the Lord's Supper, which is spiritually a good and wholesome diet. This builds you up and this makes you beautiful. So Jesus Christ uses the official means of grace as his beautician's tools to beautify his bride and wife. So Jesus Christ sanctifies and beautifies his bride, the church, by speaking to her in love. And we call that preaching. And these words come to the church and encourage her heart and make her radiant. Because a good heart livens someone up and makes them radiant. Jesus Christ beautifies his church by washing her in his blood, baptism, an unusual but highly efficacious body lotion, and he beautifies his bride by feeding her with his body and blood spiritually at the Lord's Supper for the health and beauty, that great diet for the church. You could say, therefore, the church has a Trinitarian beautician. There's the Holy God, which means he's consecrated to himself and therefore beautiful, and he works through the Holy Christ and by the Holy Spirit, who makes the church holy and therefore beautiful. Verse 26 explains by implication the duration of Christ's work as beautician. It refers to him sanctifying and cleansing the church by the washing of water by the word. And this is not merely 12 months, as with Esther, but a long-term project. For the whole of the church's earthly lifetime, the great beautician is working at this. All history long, from the call of Adam and Eve after the fall to the second coming of Jesus Christ. And then Christ the beautician's work is finished and perfected for his wedding at the end of the world, when he has the greatest and most beautiful bride ever. Verse 27 says, that he might present it to himself. Usually someone else gives the bride away, but he presents the church to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish.
So it'd be fair to say then that until that time we are holy, but we still have blemishes.
Yes, we are holy and we have blemishes, and even spots and wrinkles.
Can we also say that Christ, as a beautician, actually gives his bride his own beauty?
He does. He gives her his own beauty. Yes.
That's the best analogy, obviously. I mean, God being the God of all wisdom, to use the picture of a bride in relation to the church.
Yeah.
I mean, that's typically, certainly outwardly anyway, but you see your wife, that's when she is at her most beautiful as a bride.
Yep.
Can they use the better analogy?
Like, what is the most beautiful thing in all the world? It's women. I mean, it's obviously not men. Yeah. It's women. And it's sort of younger women, especially, and women when they're getting married. Yeah. And that's what so much money and time and effort and pain is spent on. So when God wants to talk about the beauty of the church, he picks a bride. Yeah. And really, women are beautiful. I'm turning it all around, because God wills to save a church. It's not, here's women, and so God decides to use that image, but rather God's aiming at a holy, beautiful bride, the church, and so he makes male and female and the whole world as we know it. Our last section makes the simple, obvious point and draws in the passage that we read earlier. We'll come to it after another passage. Since holiness is the church's beauty, holiness is the beauty of men and women. And Scripture, as we've been saying, especially emphasizes the latter for practical reasons. Let's look at 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 6, near the bottom of the handout. 1 Peter 3, 1 through 6 is the first of the two passages we're going to look at in this connection. What is a beautiful woman as taught in this passage, compared now to the holiness of the church and its beauty? What is the beauty of a woman in this passage? It's inner beauty. Yep, verse 4 mentions that.
Submission to husband and a meek and quiet spirit.
Yeah, it's submission or subjection to her own husband, verses 1 and 5. It's having a meek or gentle and quiet spirit, verse 4, which is internal and becomes evident by her behavior, as Philip said. It's her chaste conduct, and it's her right view of adornment and beauty. Verse 3, her adorning, she understands this, it's not the outward adorning of plaiting the hair or of wearing gold or of putting on of apparel. And again, we hasten to add that we do not think that women should not make themselves presentable. The message tonight is not, the minister says that men, and especially women, should dress up like old targes. That's not the point. We're defining the holiness and beauty of the church. And then, this passage explains not just what the beauty of a godly woman is, but it explains this in connection with Sarah in verses 5 and 6. Now, from your knowledge of Sarah, the book of Genesis, was she physically attractive?
Yes.
She was. Genesis 12 deals with that. And Abraham told lies and got himself into trouble. And despite his sin, God blessed him. But This passage doesn't say, when it's talking about female beauty, it doesn't even mention that she was an attractive woman. It isn't her beauty, ultimately. Her beauty is her godliness and her holiness. That's what God sees. And that's what this passage teaches. Let's move to the other passage, 1 Timothy 2, 9 through 15. How is a beautiful woman described in this passage? See, I want to sort of, her beauty consists in or includes X, and it's in verse. Philip, what did you say?
Super.
Okay. Yep, she's a beautiful woman. She's sober. Yep, and shamefaced. Yes. Yep. Anything else? Good works. She's adorned with good works, verse 10 says. Verse 11, this isn't the main point, but it's worth mentioning. She learns. When it says, let a woman learn in silence with all subjection, at least in English, it implies, well, she should learn. That's a good thing, just as the men should learn. Verse 15 includes childbearing. She continues in faith, charity, and holiness with sobriety again. A beautiful woman is sober, does good works, learns in the church, and bears covenant children to God's glory.
Could you imagine if you said that to the average person out of that defines largely the beauty of a woman?
Uh-huh.
None of those terms would be applicable in the worldly sense to a woman in the modern age. If I said that to some of the girls, well, it's not obviously
right now.
I was completely mad. But if you tried to say to a woman, this is what I believe makes you beautiful, they would. I think you're mad if you said this is what you ought to be to
I would think you just walked straight out of a time machine from the Middle Ages. And this is almost tyranny. This is the sort of male chauvinist piggery that we thought we'd stamped out several decades ago. But as for these women and their happiness, it's not gone up one whit. But they refuse to learn. They're sticking in their sins. So what about an ugly woman? According to 1 Timothy 2, verses 9 through 10... If Philip said this teaching would offend today's ungodly women, well, this truth will too. An ugly woman is a worldly woman. And a worldly woman, in the terms of 1 Timothy 2, verses 9 through 15, what does a worldly woman think or how does she behave that makes her spiritually ugly?
10 minutes, you want to do it.
Yes, she's seeking or in church office. Verse 12 says, I suffer not a woman to teach nor to usurp authority over a man. That is the world speaking, and such a woman, spiritually and before God, is ugly. Imagine going to a church where you have such an ugly manifestation of sin behind the pulpit, claiming to speak on behalf of God. What else?
Well, if she's encouraged to adorn herself in modest apparel, then you could flip that and say that those in the world obviously don't.
Yes. Women wearing immodest clothing are worldly and ugly. That's what the Bible says. The Bible is a way of turning everything completely on its head, because the world lives in sin and darkness. The worldly woman, the ugly woman, has a wrong view of beauty, and therefore wears immodest clothing and overdoes her outward beauty and shows off through her fancy hairdos and jewelry and expensive clothes, because she's that view of worldliness and she gets it all wrong. She may, if she's in a false church, seek church office, which again is the world. And as Philip was saying earlier, she rejects childbearing or keeps it to a bare minimum to seek her own self-fulfillment. So no matter how attractive she is physically, such a woman is worldly and therefore spiritually ugly. The more they try to make themselves beautiful, the more they actually make themselves ugly in God's sight. And this knowledge of what is and what is not true beauty is crucial, especially in our age where there has never been as much interest and certainly never been as much money and time and modern science spent on making the body beautiful. And women must think rightly here, both the younger women and the older women and the single women and the married women, but especially young single women. Because if they believe and practice worldly views of beauty, and that's what most young single women are doing, and a lot of young married women are doing, and older married women are doing, but if they do that, these young single women will attract the wrong type of man, they will date the wrong type of man, they will fornicate, and sometimes, if they're not careful, as the world would put it, they'll end up having a child outside marriage. If it gets worse, they'll end up married to an unbeliever, bringing grief to their family, and if such a young girl is in the church, she will damage the holiness of the church. And the exhortation to men is very simple, because they too need to think rightly here too, or else they will end up looking for the wrong sort of woman. Worse yet, they may not only look for the wrong sort of woman, but they may actually find the wrong sort of a woman, which is far worse. And worse again, they may actually end up marrying the wrong sort of woman, because the guy thinks the wrong view of beauty, she thinks the wrong view of beauty, and if such a guy is in the visible church, then he's going to damage the holiness of the church, or, which is perhaps even more likely, he's going to discover that he was never really part of Christ's holy, beautiful church at all. And then next week, Lord willing, we're going to start with the glory of the holiness of the church and go on from there.